Welcome to the Deep Dive, and today we are plunging into the Register RSS Feed's noon edition for Sunday, August 17th, 2025.
Quite a specific snapshot in time.
Indeed. I'm Sam McGee.
And I'm Taylor Lettuce.
So for this deep dive, we've pulled together a really interesting collection of articles from the Register, all hitting around today's date.
Right. It gives us a fascinating point in time look at things.
Exactly. And our mission, like always, is to really dig in, pull out the key insights, talk about what they actually mean, you know, the implications.
And help you get up to speed quickly on what's happening right now in tech. And frankly, society too.
We're covering a lot of ground today. Everything from, you know, the everyday frustrations of using Windows.
Oh, I feel that one already.
Yeah. All the way through to some pretty heavy ethical questions about AI in open source and policing.
And even touching on the future of the internet itself and the kind of personal tech we might be using. It's quite a mix.
It really is.
And I think what's really striking about these sources taken together is how they just perfectly capture this complex interplay right now, you know, between the tech itself, the policies trying to catch up, and just us, human behavior.
Yeah, how we react to it all.
Exactly. And often you read these pieces and they raise more questions than they actually answer, which I think really underlines how complex this digital age is becoming.
Definitely. It's not simple stuff. Okay, so let's dive into the first piece. This one hits close to home for probably millions of us. Windows.
Ah, Windows. Our old friend. Or so, depending on the day.
Right. So the article kicks off with a pretty sharp critique. It argues Microsoft keeps adding features that, well, basically nobody wants.
Like those constant Xbox Game Pass pop-ups.
Exactly. Or forcing you to use a Microsoft account for everything. While at the same time, they seem to be ignoring what users actually need to get work done.
The core complaint, as the article puts it, is that the corporate parent isn't a good listener. Which, ouch.
Yeah, and it leads to things the article calls, quote, useless local AI features, and this growing feeling that Windows is turning into, well, a piece of spyware.
Especially with things like recall or the mandatory sign-ins, it feels less like your personal computer sometimes.
It really does, like you're being pushed in directions you didn't choose.
Well, and it's interesting because there's this tension, right? Microsoft, specifically their corporate VP, Pavan Davuluri, talks about this long-term vision.
Right, the agentic and multimodal thing.
Exactly. Voice, vision, touch. Basically interacting with Windows in totally new ways, beyond just mouse and keyboard. And they're pouring resources into that.
Huge investment, yeah.
But as the article nails, the big question is, who's actually asking for these specific changes? Is this coming from users, or is it a top-down strategy from Microsoft focused on AI and cloud?
It feels very top-down. I mean, seriously, who is out there begging for local image generation in Paint?
When there are perfectly good, often better cloud options right there, even from Microsoft.
Exactly, or AI and tabs and Notepad. Notepad, its whole beauty is simplicity.
Right, don't mess with Notepad.
And don't even get me started on those, like, tabloid headlines popping up in the taskbar widget. Nobody asked for that.
It really shows this disconnect the article talks about. Corporate ambition versus actual user need.
But it's not just complaining. The article actually proposes 10 features that arguably would make a difference, things that could actually boost productivity.
Okay, now we're talking practical stuff.
Yeah, let's get into these. Number one, multiple clipboards.
Okay, interesting.
Think about it. Copy-paste is kind of amazing, right? We take it for granted.
Totally. A miracle of modern computing.
And Windows key plus V for history is okay. It's an improvement. But the article says what we really need is maybe a second or even a third dedicated clipboard.
How would that work?
Simple idea. Different keyboard shortcuts, like one combo copies to clipboard one, another to clipboard two, maybe another to clipboard three. Same for pasting.
Ah, so you could hold text in one and image in another without overwriting.
Exactly. Keep them both instantly accessible.
You know, that's not just a small thing. For certain workflows, that's huge.
Right.
Like if you're constantly pulling bits of text from one document and images from another for a report, that juggling act is so inefficient.
Constantly copying, pasting somewhere safe, copying the next thing.
Yeah. And sure, the article mentions you could probably script this with auto hotkey or something.
But you shouldn't have to. It's such a basic workflow improvement.
Precisely. The fact that you need a workaround means the OS is lacking something fundamental. It's these little friction points that kill productivity.
Totally agree. Okay, number two. Two or three clocks in the taskbar.
Ah, yes. For the globally connected.
You get it. Working at the register, I always need UTC time visible. That's our publishing time.
Hmm.
But I also need my local time, obviously.
And Windows lets you add clocks, but they're hidden, right?
Exactly. You have to hover or click on the main clock. I don't want to hover or click. I want it right there, on the taskbar, all the time.
It seems like such a basic UI principle, doesn't it? Critical info should be instantly visible.
Especially for teams spread across time zones. Coordinating anything requires knowing those times at a glance.
And the current way, right-click, settings, add clocks, then hover, it's just cumbersome. It's friction again. A simple, persistent display would solve it.
A tiny change, huge impact for some people. All right, number three, add a fourth modifier key.
Ooh, now you're talking radical. A new key.
Well, think about it. Keyboard shortcuts are amazing for efficiency, right? Save so much time.
Absolutely. Anything to avoid reaching for the mouse.
But the problem is, most of the good, easy-to-remember key combinations are already taken. By the OS, by apps, often for things you barely use.
True. You end up with these contorted CTRL plus ALT plus Shift plus something combos.
So the idea is a new MOD key, reserved only for user shortcuts. You assign what MOD plus whatever does.
So MOD plus C could be your second clipboard copy. MOD plus V pastes from it. Without messing up regular CTRL plus CV.
Exactly. It frees up a whole new namespace for custom shortcuts.
You know, it's not unprecedented. Keyboards didn't always have a Windows key. Microsoft added that back in 94.
Good point. And they just pushed the Copilot key on us, which, debatable utility for many.
Right. So if they can make hardware vendors add that, why not a genuinely useful, user-customizable MOD key? It would really expand how we interact with the machine.
It would unlock so much potential for power users, which actually leads perfectly into number four.
Let me guess, more customization.
You got it. Allow remapping of all keyboard shortcuts.
Total control.
Why not? If I, for some crazy reason, wanted CTRL plus A to copy instead of select all, maybe just to mess with myself.
You should have the right to shoot yourself in the foot, digitally speaking.
Huh, yeah. Basically. Or maybe I genuinely prefer CTRL plus F for select all. The point is, it should be my choice. Complete control over the shortcuts.
And this really speaks to that philosophy of user empowerment, doesn't it? Making the tool fit your workflow, not forcing you into a predefined box.
Exactly. Power users live and die by efficiency. Personalized shortcuts are key to that muscle memory optimization.
It definitely pushes back against this trend of simplified lockdown systems where the user gets fewer and fewer choices. It's about user agency.
Absolutely. Okay, number five, bring back the movable, resizable taskbar.
Oh, the nostalgia. Windows 10 flexibility.
Remember, you could drag it taller, thinner, stick it on the top, left, right, wherever you wanted.
Super useful, especially on multi-monitor setups or if you just like it on the side.
And then Windows 11 came along and Nope. Gone for, as the article says, no particular reason at all.
It felt arbitrary, didn't it? Like simplification for simplification's sake, not for user benefit.
The article jokes it's like the McRib strategy, take something away, then bring it back later and act like it's a great new feature.
It does erode trust, though, taking away existing functionality that people relied on, especially for those with specific screen layouts. That side taskbar was crucial for organizing things visually.
Yeah, simplification isn't always improvement. Sometimes flexibility is better.
Definitely.
Number six, and this one really speaks to me, a firewall for audio.
Okay, intrigued. What does that mean?
Think about unexpected noises from your computer, a random ad starting to play in a background tab, an app making some weird notification sound.
Oh, yes, the concentration killers.
Even if you're working alone, it's jarring. The idea is simple. Apps and even individual browser tabs should have to ask permission before making noise.
Like user account control. But for sound.
Exactly. A pop-up saying, this app wants to play audio. Allow, deny. And importantly, with include exclude lists so you don't have to approve VLC every single time.
That's actually a brilliant concept. Extending permissions beyond data to sensory input. Protecting your focus.
Right. It's about digital quietude. Controlling the noise.
Unexpected sounds are so disruptive to deep work. Giving users that granular control down to the browser tab. That would be a massive improvement to the computing experience. Less jarring. More predictable.
Couldn't agree more. Number seven, pin apps to specific screens.
A multi-monitor user's dream.
Totally. If you've got more than one screen, you probably have a preferred spot for certain apps, right? Like Slack always goes on the top right monitor, email on the left.
Constantly dragging Windows around every time you open them gets old fast.
So the idea is Windows should let you just pin an app, say Slack, to always open on monitor two.
Simple, but effective.
But it gets better. The advanced idea is pinning multiple apps to one screen, and Windows automatically splits the screen between them in your preferred layout.
Okay, now that's smart. Predefined workspaces, essentially. It's all about optimizing that digital workspace, reducing the mental effort of window management. If you use multiple monitors, that manual ranging is a constant low-level drag on productivity.
This would streamline things hugely. Just click and your whole setup for a task appears.
Eliminates that whole setup dance.
Which brings us neatly to number 8. Program groups launch multiple related apps at once.
Kind of like a macro for starting your workday.
Pretty much. Think about different modes you work in. Web dev mode might need your code editor, FTP client, database tool, a couple of specific browsers.
The writing mode might need word processor, research tabs open, maybe Photoshop, Slack.
Exactly. Instead of clicking 5, 6, 7 icons individually, you'd have one shortcut, maybe web dev startup, that launches everything you need, maybe even opens the right web pages all at once.
Again, you can do this with scripting tools like AutoHotkey.
But it should be built in. It's such a common need.
It really raises the question of how the OS should support complex workflows natively. It's like batch processing your task setup.
Think of the time saved just getting started on projects. Those minutes add up.
Definitely. Makes it accessible to everyone, not just scripters.
All right, number 9. And wait, this is a big one for many people, especially in the hybrid work era. Make audio device switching easy.
Ugh, don't get me started. The bane of Windows 11 existence.
It feels like it sometimes, trying to get sound to come out of your headset, but it insists on using the monitor speakers or vice versa. It's a daily struggle for some.
And the frantic clicking through sound settings when you realize your private call is blasting out to the whole room.
The worst. The article points out the easiest fix is often just unplugging the device you don't want to use or using a USB hub with switches, which is ridiculous.
It really is.
The proposal. A super quick switch right on the taskbar. Even better. Let Windows associate devices with apps. Headphones for Zoom Teams, speakers for browser music. Automatically.
That would be life-changing for hybrid workers.
Yeah.
The stress of audio glitches right before a call is immense.
It seems like such a minor UI issue, but it has a huge impact on communication and just sanity.
Absolutely. It's a fundamental usability fail in a world reliant on virtual comms.
Okay, finally, number 10. And this one feels like it should be obvious, but clearly isn't to Microsoft. Cut the Microsoft-induced distractions.
Ah, the relentless shilling.
Yes, just make Windows shut up. Stop trying to sell me stuff. OneDrive, Microsoft 365, Game Pass.
The pop-ups, the notifications, the suggestions.
The article calls them Windows productivity sinks, which is perfect. Yes, you can usually disable them if you dig deep enough.
But you shouldn't have to.
Exactly. Why is my OS interrupting my work to tell me about a movie trailer in the widget board or asking me to sign up for Game Pass?
It's fundamentally about respecting the user's attention, isn't it? The primary purpose of the OS should be to help you get stuff done, not serve as a marketing channel.
It feels like basic design ethics. Don't distract the user unnecessarily.
These constant interruptions, even tiny ones, they fragment your focus, they add cognitive load. It just makes everything harder.
So yeah, the overall feeling from the article is pretty clear.
Stop the shilling, start being helpful.
Basically, yeah. Maybe focus on these kinds of real productivity boosters instead of, you know, AI features that a browser does better anyway. Seems simple.
It really does raise that question. With all this talk about AI revolutionizing productivity, why are these basic, frequently requested OS improvements still being ignored?
It highlights that gap, doesn't it? Between corporate priorities, chasing the next big thing, and what users actually need day to day.
The real disconnect.
Yeah.
It's less about refining the present, more about pushing a specific future, whether users want it or not.
Okay, so let's shift gears now. We're moving from those, you know, daily OS frustrations to something maybe more systemic and frankly a bit worrying.
Right, how AI is starting to cause real problems for online communities.
Exactly. This next article is titled Codeberg Beset by AI Bots That Now Bypass Anubis Defense. Codeberg, for context, is a Berlin-based code hosting site, sort of an alternative to GitHub.
And they're having bot problems.
Big time. They had this defense mechanism called Anubis.
Anubis sounds ominous.
Kinda, yeah. The article describes it as a part pit. Basically, before you could access Codeberg fully, your browser had to do some heavy computation.
Ah, like a proof of work thing, to prove you're a real browser, not a scraper bot.
Exactly. The idea was, real users wouldn't mind the one-off hit, but AI crawlers trying to scrape everything would find it too computationally expensive. And apparently, it worked well for a while.
Save him from managing huge block lists, presumably.
Right. But the bad news is, these AI bots have now figured out how to get past Anubis. They can do the heavy computation.
Wow, okay. That shows a leap in bot sophistication.
And the impact. Codeberg's staff said it basically acts like a DDoS attack. It caused extreme slowness on the site. Some bots even seem to be coming from Huawei networks in China.
So it's genuinely disrupting their service for legitimate developers.
Yeah, it's not just a background nuisance.
This really brings up that question of the hidden costs of the AI boom, doesn't it? Especially for open source projects?
How so?
Well, Bradley M. Kuhn from the Software Freedom Conservancy is quoted, and he puts it bluntly. He says, these bots, driven by this insatiable greed for more and more training data for LLMs,
are essentially attacking the good guys.
Pretty much. He says they're launching DDoS attacks against the kindest and most giving people in our community, open source devs. He thinks companies running these training bots should be ashamed.
Strong words.
And there's even an ethical debate about Anubis itself. The Free Software Foundation apparently has issues with it, saying it's like crypto mining code, potentially malware, because it forces computation on the user's machine.
But Codeberg sees it as a necessary defense.
Right. And they're looking at alternatives now, like something called Iocane. It's a tough spot for them.
And this frustration isn't just Codeberg, right? The article mentions other examples.
Yeah, the Curl Project, for instance. They're apparently really fed up with getting bug reports generated by AI assistants that are just garbage.
Wasting their time.
Exactly. And developers have been asking GitHub, which is Microsoft, deeply tied into Copilot AI for ages now, please let us block AI-generated issues and pull requests on our repos.
But GitHub hasn't done it.
Apparently not effectively enough. One developer, Andy McClure, even threatened to just shut down issues and PRs entirely and maybe move issue tracking to Codeberg if things don't change.
Wow, that's drastic.
It really highlights the irony, doesn't it? People are leaving GitHub partly because of Microsoft using their code to train AI and integrating Copilot so deeply.
Only to find similar AI bot problems on the alternative platform.
Exactly. It shows how pervasive this AI data scraping issue is becoming.
Yeah.
Kuhn still argues for leaving GitHub on principle, citing ethics and Microsoft's training data practices, but it's clear there's no easy escape from the bot problem right now.
It really feels like a clash between the commercial AI gold rush and the open source community ethos.
A fundamental tension, yeah. It's escalating.
Okay, so from code hosting headaches, let's turn to something even more fundamental to society, democracy itself.
And AI's impact there. Not good, I'm guessing.
Yeah. This next article is pretty sobering. It focuses on election workers in the U.S., and the picture it paints is concerning, not just the physical threats they're facing, which are bad enough,
but also AI amplifying misinformation.
Exactly. It's making a dangerous situation potentially much worse. The article shares some really disturbing personal stories.
This is where digital threats get very real, very fast.
Absolutely. Take Bill Gates, the Arizona election official, not the Microsoft guy.
Right. Important distinction.
He told the Register the death threats started right after the 2020 election because he and others wouldn't go along with the stolen election narrative.
Just for doing their job and upholding the results.
Yeah. Then on January 6, 2021, while the Capitol riot was happening, the sheriff told him to leave his house because his address had been doxxed. He spent two nights in hiding with his family.
That's terrifying.
And it happened again on election night in 2022. He even got an email saying, basically, I know who prepares your food. I'm going to poison it.
My God. Was the person caught?
Yeah, thankfully. Got 3 years probation. But still.
And he's not alone, the article says.
No. Natalie Adona, a registrar in California, talked about protests, people refusing masks, even someone waiting outside her house, causing her panic attacks.
The psychological toll must be immense.
And Tina Barton, another election expert, mentioned the person who threatened her got out of prison just this past June.
So the threat is ongoing. Even after convictions, it's just awful.
And these officials all stress how vital CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and the FBI were for support between 2020 and 2024.
CISA, yeah, they play a huge role in election security.
Bill Gates said, knowing CISA had our back gave us a great feeling of support, but now they're terrified about 2026.
Why? Potential budget cuts.
Exactly. Under a potential second Trump administration, they expect CISA's headcount and budget to shrink rapidly. They worry about losing not just cyber help, but also that crucial hands-on support in the analog world.
That raises a huge question, doesn't it? What happens if that federal support structure is weakened or dismantled?
It puts all the pressure back on local officials,
who are already juggling election law, procurement, HR, and now they're supposed to be cyber and physical security experts too.
Yeah.
The article says it's just too much.
It seems impossible, and it creates this massive vulnerability in the system.
The data backs this up too, right? The Brennan Center survey.
Yeah, overwhelmingly. 61% worried about CISA cuts. 80% want the same or more support. 76% say their budgets need to grow just to keep up.
And nearly 40% have faced harassment or threats personally.
Natalie Adona mentioned relying on CISA for low or no-cost security tools they couldn't afford otherwise.
And Tina Barton credited CISA's collaborative planning and exercises for why things didn't totally fall apart in 2024, despite huge challenges.
Like what?
Well, she mentioned handling over 200 bomb threats, fentanyl in the mail, swatting, ballot boxes exploding, things that could have caused chaos.
But they had plans in place thanks to that collaboration.
Exactly. You didn't see the chaos erupt. Because we already had plans, she said. That proactive federal support was key.
And now layer AI onto this already fragile situation.
Right. This is where it gets even scarier. Natalie Adona put it perfectly.
What did she say?
There is a ton of false information circulating. And now with artificial intelligence, being able to amplify false information, it's really a serious concern. It is very hard to unring a bell.
Unring a bell. That's a good way to put it. Once the lie is out there.
Especially when AI can make it look so convincing. Deep fake audio, video, realistic but totally false narratives. Spreading faster than officials can possibly debunk them.
It creates this perfect storm, doesn't it? Physical threats, less federal support, and AI supercharging the lies.
A recipe for disaster in 2026, potentially. It's not just a tech challenge anymore. It's a direct threat to democracy's foundations.
And the article also mentions the worry about losing information sharing, right? The EI, I see.
Yeah, that central hub where officials share threat intel.
Yeah.
If that goes or gets weaker, everyone's more isolated.
Like Tina Barton said, a tiny community in Michigan can't fight off a Russian cyber attack on its own.
They need that federal umbrella, that early warning system CISA provides. Without it, smaller places are incredibly vulnerable.
It's a really worrying picture overall. Okay, let's shift location now across the pond to the UK.
And sticking with AI, but in a different context.
Yep, AI and policing. This article discusses a UK government scheme that sounds, well, straight out of Minority Report.
Uh-oh, predictive policing.
Pretty much. The goal is, quote, help police catch criminals before they strike. Not with psychics, thankfully.
Small mercies. So how?
With detailed interactive crime maps. They plan to feed massive amounts of data into AI models, police records, council data, social services info.
Trying to predict crime hotspots. Or even potential offenders.
Both, it seems. Looking at criminal records, past incidents, locations, even behavioral patterns of known offenders.
Wow, and this is a serious plan.
Apparently so. Prototypes by April 2026, fully operational across England and Wales by 2030, part of a $500 million R&D program.
That's a significant investment.
And the official line is optimistic, naturally. The science and tech secretary talks about AI improving lives, keeping us safe. Some community safety groups welcomed it, too.
You can see the appeal, can't you? More efficient policing, stopping crime before it happens. It's the promise governments everywhere are chasing with AI.
It is an appealing promise on the surface.
But there's always a but with this stuff.
A big one. Civil liberties groups like Big Brother Watch are sounding major alarms.
What are their main concerns?
Their spokesperson called the plans deeply chilling and dystopian. Strong language.
Okay, so what are the specific worries?
Several key things. First, it risks treating people as data points, making them suspects based on algorithms, not actions.
Guilt by association or potential association.
Second, and this is crucial, relying on historic data risks, amplifying existing biases.
The bias in, bias out problem. If past policing was biased against certain groups or areas.
The AI learns that bias and predicts more crime there, leading to more policing there, reinforcing the bias. A vicious cycle.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy of surveillance. Yeah, that's a huge concern with predictive policing systems everywhere.
Third, just the sheer amount of vast amounts of sensitive personal data being hoovered up. Huge privacy implications.
Who gets access? How is it secured? How long is it kept? Mm-hmm. All those questions.
And finally, they argue it could erode our most basic rights, undermining the presumption of innocence and leading to profound injustices.
It really pits that desire for security against fundamental freedoms, doesn't it? The whole idea of pre-crime is ethically loaded.
Definitely. And the government tried to address the privacy concerns.
Oh.
A spokesperson from UK Research and Innovation talked about using crime databases, socio-demographic data, even online behavioral data platform.
Online behavioral data. Wow, okay.
But they promised a robust ethics framework, independent reviews, safeguarding monthly evaluations.
And anonymization.
They claimed strict anonymization and consent procedures.
Which sounds good, but
yeah.
How do you truly anonymize data that includes location, demographics, behavior patterns, and still use it effectively for predicting crime in specific places?
That seems like the impossible tightrope, doesn't it?
It really does. True anonymization that retains predictive utility is notoriously difficult. There's always a risk of re-identification or creating profiles that lead to exactly the kind of injustices people fear.
Government assurances often sound good on paper, but the implementation details are where the risks lie.
And the potential for unintended consequences with systems this powerful is just enormous.
Okay, so we've seen AI causing headaches and raising serious ethical flags.
Yep.
Let's pivot now to efforts trying to steer AI and tech in a more positive, human-centric direction.
A bit of hope, maybe.
Let's see. This next piece is about the Mozilla Foundation, you know, the Firefox people.
Right. Champions of the open web.
They're actively trying to redefine their mission for what their executive director, Nabiha Syed, calls the era of Trump and AI.
Interesting framing. So what's the new mission?
Still fundamentally about supporting an open, inclusive, equitable internet. But really emphasizing prioritizing people over corporate interests, especially now with AI booming.
Applying their core values to this new AI landscape.
Exactly. Syed sees AI as the next frontier, just part of the continuum from browsers to social media to generative AI. It's all part of the digital experience.
And the goal is to keep human well-being central.
Yeah, she talks about making sure that public benefit and private enrichment are in balance and centering human beings. It's about using tech to boost creativity and connection, not just profits or control.
That's a refreshing perspective in the current climate.
Yeah.
It's applying those first principles of the open web to AI.
And they have concrete projects trying to do this, like Common Voice.
Ah, yes, I've heard of that. The crowdsourced voice data project.
Right. Collecting speech data in tons of different languages, Flemish, Catalan, and the languages commercial companies often ignore.
Because they aren't profitable enough to focus on.
Exactly. So Common Voice fills that gap, creating datasets to train speech recognition for everyone, not just speakers of major languages.
And big companies use it, but so do smaller groups.
Yeah, Meta and NVIDIA use it, but the article mentions activists using it too, like building a chatbot to help farmers sell produce in a specific Rwandan dialect, really grassroots stuff.
That's fantastic. It's about democratizing the data needed for AI development.
They also have this data collective initiative. Syed envisions it as a sort of marketplace for sharing valuable data sets like biodiversity data in a controlled, ethical way.
So not just scraping data, but licensing it properly, making it discoverable.
Yeah, giving creators or curators control and ensuring benefits are shared more widely. It's about building infrastructure for a fairer AI ecosystem.
These are really practical steps towards that human-centric vision.
But they're doing this advocacy work in a tricky political environment, right? Under an administration often seen as very pro-business.
How does Syed navigate that?
She makes a careful distinction. Mozilla is pro-human, which is not anti-business. The goal is to bring everyone, corporations, activists, users to the table for a nuanced take on innovation.
So finding ways for tech to benefit everyone, not just the giants.
That's the aim. And they're pushing for specific legislation, too.
Like what?
Things like data access rights, more transparency about how data is used, and crucially, meaningful open source for AI, not just open model weights.
So more than just releasing the final AI model, but transparency about the training data and process.
Exactly. Syed makes a powerful point about people already using AI like ChatGPT for deeply personal things, therapy, companionship, even grief.
And her argument is we can't just trust the companies building these tools to self-regulate.
Precisely. She says, to say that no one but the company will have access to the data to assess how that actually works, what that does to our loneliness, that's untenable. She refuses to accept that.
That's a really strong stance on the need for independent oversight and research into AI's societal impacts, especially for mental health applications.
She also talked about privacy, drawing on her background at the Markup, which investigates tech's impact.
Is she optimistic about privacy?
Surprisingly, yes, to a degree. She feels the risk is palpable now in a way it wasn't even after Snowden. people feel the potential harms more directly.
Like authoritarian governments using data, or just the sheer power imbalance with tech companies.
Yeah. And because the risks feel more real, she thinks people are finally becoming willing to change their behavior regarding privacy.
That's interesting. The idea that tangible risk, not just abstract awareness, is the catalyst for change.
It suggests we might be at a turning point where public demand for privacy-respecting tech could actually start shifting the market and policy.
A potential shift from passive acceptance to active demand. That would be significant.
Okay, so from Mozilla's big vision, let's zoom right down to a very specific, practical AI product.
Grounding things in the everyday.
Exactly. This last article reviews the Time Kettle T1 AI Translator. It's pitched as a device to help you scale the Tower of Babel, especially when you're offline.
A dedicated translator device? Interesting niche.
Yeah, it's small, light, like an old iPhone 4, weighs about 115 grams, runs Android 10, got a 4-inch screen.
And the key is the offline translation.
That's the big selling point. It supports over 30 downloadable language packs for offline use. Each one takes up a fair bit of space, 250, 350 millibit.
Does it have connectivity too?
Yep, it has an onboard eSIM with 2 years of free data included, works in over 150 countries. So it can do online translation too, which is presumably faster and maybe more accurate.
2 years free data is pretty generous.
It is. The review found it pretty handy overall. Worked okay in noisy places, quiet places, though it was a bit sluggish offline compared to online.
What about accuracy? Time Kettle makes claims.
They claim 90% accuracy and 0.2 second translation time offline. The review said accuracy varied, as you'd expect, depending on the situation.
Makes sense. And it has different modes.
Yeah, a simple speak and translate mode, a listen mode for recording meetings, a chat mode for conversations, and a photo mode using its camera to translate text. Pretty versatile.
Okay, but here's the big question. Why buy this for $299 when Google Translate on your phone does a lot of that, including offline downloads and camera translation for free?
That's the elephant in the room, right? The review asks exactly that.
What's Time Kettle's answer?
They argue the built-in global cellular coverage is a big plus, no fiddling with SIMs or expensive roaming. And they claim the on-device translation is faster and better optimized than phone apps.
So better performance in a dedicated package, plus the convenience of built-in data.
That's their pitch. A spokesperson said it offers high-end translation performance and exceptional value compared to apps or paying for human translators.
It really comes down to market segmentation, doesn't it? Is there a group who needs something more than a smartphone app?
Exactly. Who is this actually for?
Maybe frequent travelers who absolutely need reliable offline translation without hassle. Or professionals who need a dedicated tool that won't drain their phone battery or require them to constantly unlock their phone.
Yeah, someone who values the focused experience, the reliability, maybe the speed, enough to pay for a separate device.
It's that trade-off between the convenience of an all-in-one smartphone versus the potentially superior performance and focused nature of a dedicated tool.
So the review concludes it's useful for regular travelers, offline works well, it's light, easy to use.
But pricey. You really need to need it.
Precisely. You have to be sure you'll use it enough to justify that $299.
Makes sense. A niche but potentially valuable product for the right user.
Okay, so let's try and tie all these threads together. We've covered a lot of ground.
From Windows annoyances to existential threats. Quite the range.
Yeah, yeah. So we started with that ongoing struggle for operating systems that are actually intuitive and productive, using Windows as our case study, that disconnect between corporate vision and what users actually need.
Then we shifted to the unintended consequences of AI, like the bots plaguing open source communities like Codeberg. Real headaches caused by that relentless data scraping.
And then the really serious stuff, the impact on election security, where AI-fueled misinformation meets physical threats and potentially dwindling federal support. A deeply worrying picture.
Followed by the complex ethics of AI in government, like the UK's predictive policing plans, raising those fundamental questions about bias, privacy, and civil liberties.
But we also looked at the flip side of organizations like Mozilla trying to champion a more human-centered internet and ethical AI development.
And grounded it all with a practical example, the Time Kettle Translator, showing how dedicated AI devices are emerging for specific needs.
So weaving it all together, what's the big takeaway?
I think if you connect all these dots, it becomes incredibly clear that our digital future isn't just about the technology itself advancing. It's really about the choices we're making.
Choices about what?
About control, about privacy, about accountability.
Mm-hmm.
As AI gets embedded deeper into everything, our operating systems, our elections, how our safety is determined, how we communicate. we face this fundamental question. Are we just passively accepting the future that's being built for us, often by very powerful companies and governments with their own agendas? Or are we actively stepping up, thinking critically, and demanding to shape the future we actually want to live in?
Passively accept or actively shape. That's a stark choice.
It is, and it demands constant engagement and critical thinking from all of us, because the stakes for our work, our society, our rights are incredibly high.
A really powerful thought to end on. Definitely something for all of us to keep mulling over as we navigate this rapidly changing landscape.
Indeed.
Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive.
Until next time.